after.
Decaf cappuccino and a brownie, the server calls. And then, when there's no response, half a decaf cappuccino with cinnamon and a hazelnut brownie.
Oh, Hannah shakes herself out of her reverie. Yes, that's me, thank you. Sorry, I wasn't paying attention.
The boy puts the coffee and brownie down on the table along with the receipt. Hannah picks up the cup and takes a sip. It's good. The coffee at cafeteria always is. But when she glances at the bill, she puts the cup down. £7.40. Was cafeteria always so expensive? Maybe she shouldn't have ordered that brownie. She isn't even hungry. Her phone rings, vibrating its way across the table with a suddenness that makes her jump. It's probably another bloody reporter calling from an unregistered number. Picking up the caller that morning was a mistake. She would never have done it if she'd been paying attention. But when she digs the phone out of her bag, the caller ID gives her a jolt of surprise. Emily Lipman. She picks up.
Em, this is unexpected.
It is. She hasn't heard from Emily for maybe 2 years. It's not that they haven't kept in touch, exactly. They've been Facebook friends since uni, so Hannah knows about Emily's flourishing academic career. She and Hugh are the only ones who really lived up to the promise of those early days. She's read the impenetrable academic maths papers that Emily posts with a faux casual, "So, wrote a thing," that belies the intense ambition Hannah remembers from Pelham. And for her part, Emily responds to Hannah's infrequent posts with what seems like genuine affection. "Let me know next time you're down south," she wrote last time Hannah posted a picture from Dodsworth. But posting on Facebook is a false kind of intimacy. And in real life, they haven't seen or spoken to each other for a long time, not since Ryan's wedding. In fact, she wasn't even sure Emily had this number, though she remembers passing it round last time she swapped.
"Well, I saw the news,"
Emily says now. Her disconcerting directness, at least, hasn't changed, and that realisation gives Hannah a reassuring feeling of familiarity.
"You okay?"
"Yes," Hannah says, with more certainty than she feels. "I mean, it was a shock. But yes."
"And I heard from Hugh that you're pregnant. Congratulations."
"Thanks." The news that Emily is still in touch with Hugh is somehow a surprise. She's never thought of them as firm friends. "I didn't know you kept up with Hugh."
"Just occasionally. He came down to an alumni carol service last year. Seems like he visits Oxford quite regularly. He said you and Will never come?"
"No, well, I mean, Edinburgh to Oxford is a long way," Hannah says, though she knows the excuse must sound feeble, particularly since Hugh also lives in Edinburgh. "It's a trek."
"Yeah,"
Emily says, but not like she's fooled. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out why Hannah might not want to return to Pelham. "Did you go to the Gordy last year?" Hannah asks, more to divert the conversation than because she really wants to know. Personally, she can't think of anything worse than hanging around with their former classmates, reminiscing about the best years of their lives. What would she say? The truth? That April haunts her like an unquiet ghost? That her short time at Pelham ended in a long nightmare she spent the rest of her life trying to wake up from?
"No,"
Emily is saying.
"Hugh did, I think, but I'm not really into the whole reunion thing. But I have been back to dine a couple of times. Not often. I find the whole alumni deal unbearably smug most of the time. But I thought since I was back in Oxford, I should show willing, you know, work the old network a bit.
Oh! Memory comes back to Hannah, something Will said last year. I forgot you weren't in London anymore. You're a fellow at Balliol College, is that right? Is that a step up from Pelham?
Yes, practically come full circle.
Emily's voice is dry.
As for a step up, I don't know. Balliol would probably try to say so, but as far as I can see, the only difference is the wine cellar at Balliol is better.
What's it like, being back?
Weird, to be honest. At first, anyway.
She stops. There is a long silence. Hannah is just trying to think what to say when Emily finally speaks, her voice quieter than before.
Han, are you really okay?
For a moment, Hannah can't reply. She closes her eyes, pushes her glasses up her forehead, and digs her fingers into the bony hollows on either side of the bridge of her nose. Yes, she says at last. And no. I mean, no, I'm not okay, really, but I'm not okay. Does that make sense?
Yes,
Emily says. She sounds sad.
Because I feel the same.
There is another silence between them. And for a moment, Hannah has the strangest impression that no time has passed at all. That the two of them are back in Oxford, phoning room to room. And for a sharp, piercing moment, she wishes it were true. That she could run down the corridor and tell Emily she's going to the JCR and does she want a coffee? Then Emily speaks again, her voice stronger this time.
Oh, hey, I meant to ask. Has a reporter called Geraint Williams been trying to get in touch with you?
The name gives Hannah an odd prickle coming so close on the heels of the email. She nods, forgetting Emily can't see her, and then says, yes, I mean, he emailed me, but I didn't reply. I didn't even really read it. How come?
I don't know. He's been after me to talk to him. I said no, of course, but I don't know. He's a friend of Ryan's, apparently.
Of Ryan's? It's a shock. Hannah's not sure why, except that Ryan, out of all of them, is the person she feels most guilty about abandoning after college.
From his days at the Herald. He said it was Ryan who got him interested in the case. Have you seen him?
Geraint?
No, Ryan.
Emily sounds impatient. No, not since his stroke. Hannah bites her lip. Have you?
Only once. When he was first released from hospital. It was so awful, I kind of couldn't bear to go back. But from what Geraint said, he's in a better place now.
Oh, I mean, I'm glad, Hannah says uncertainly. It is what she feared, and part of the reason she never plucked up the courage to visit, not just the memories it would have stirred up, but the memories it would have erased. The image in her head of the laughing, handsome, mocking boy overwritten by a slurring wreck.
Geraint said his memory still isn't great and he's in a wheelchair, but he's had a lot of physiotherapy and apparently his speech is pretty good now. Plus, he's able to feed himself and stuff, which must make a huge difference to someone as independent as him. I could see how much he was hating being dependent on Bella. And he's writing again. I haven't read any of it, but Geraint said he's able to type, and that must be a huge release.
I'm glad, Hannah says again. And then, because the question is niggling at her,
So, what did he want? Geraint, I mean. Just the usual? The usual. Soft focus, syrupy memories of April and her potential. Sad-faced pictures of her friends and family, pondering all they've lost. Anecdotes about punting and May balls and bright futures. And then some spicy detail, just to add a prurient kick to the piece. A hint of scandal, maybe a student rivalry. A sniff of drugs or promiscuity or some other act of disreputable behaviour to give the reader a frisson of disapproval and the safe knowledge that this would never have happened to them. That they or their kids or their grandchildren are far too responsible ever to get lured in by a predator and strangled in their own room. She hates them. The journalists, the podcasters, the thought of what it must still be doing to April's parents after all this time. She hates them all.
Not the usual,
Emily says slowly.
At least, not the April I knew by Emily Lipman bullshit, if that's what you mean by the usual. No, he...
She stops. Hannah knows that she is trying to find a way to put something potentially upsetting into words, and she sets down her coffee cup, bracing herself for whatever Em might be about to say.
He thinks Neville was innocent,
Emily says at last.
He thinks they made a mistake.
Before. 4 weeks into the first semester, or rather Michaelmas term, as she had already learned to call it, and Hannah felt like she had been at Oxford forever, but also that she would never get used to this miracle. It was so strange that it was possible to experience both states at the same time. Both the wonder of waking up in an 18th century room in one of the world's oldest centres of learning, hearing the chapel bells tolling and the high, ethereal voices of the Pelham College choir boys floating up to her windows, and yet, at the same time, to feel the reassuring rhythm of Meatloaf Mondays in the dining hall, Hugh's regular grumbles about the smell of pot noodles stinking up his room from the Claude kitchen, and the daily visits from the staircase scout, bossy, motherly Sue. The strangest thing of all was that she and April seemed to have become de facto best friends, in spite of the fact that back in Dodsworth, Hannah was fairly sure she would have gone out of her way to avoid someone as intimidatingly beautiful and conspicuously wealthy as April. Now, thrown together by the simple fact of sharing a room, they seemed to be taken for granted. April and Hannah. Hannah and April. Friends, roommates, conspirators. She's such a cow, April complained. It was Friday night, and she was sprawled across the sofa eating dry Cocoa Pops from a bowl, wearing a hand-painted dressing gown in Japanese silk. She was watching The Breakfast Club on her laptop and scrolling through the brand new Instagram app on her iPhone. I swear she waits until I'm either maximum hungover or got a massive deadline to come and hoover. Who? Hannah adjusted the hood of her gown in the mirror. It was formal hall tonight, which meant if you wanted a cooked dinner, you had to dress the part. Academic gown and smart clothes. Although in practice, smart tended to mean no ripped jeans. She glanced over April's shoulder to check the time on her laptop. 7:25. Emily had promised to call past on her way over to the hall, but they were cutting it fine if they wanted to find seats together.
I told you, Sue. Were you not listening?
She's got to get through the rooms, Hannah said mildly.
She hates me ever since I pranked her with that bowl of glitter on top of the wardrobe, April said.
She put a spoonful of Cocoa Pops in her mouth and crunched them noisily. Bitch. April was, Hannah had discovered, an inveterate practical joker. It was one of the more unnerving things about sharing a room with her, though not sharing a room didn't lessen the risk. She had got Ryan with a fake call, summoning him to see the master, who was not pleased to be interrupted at 10:30 on a Sunday night. Hannah's own gotcha had been coming up the stairs one night after dinner to hear panicked screams coming from April's bedroom. She had rushed into the room to see two pale hands scrabbling helplessly at the edge of the open window frame. It was only when she had raced across the room, her heart in her mouth, and grabbed one of the hands by the wrist, that she had looked down to see April standing safely on the projecting bay window below, laughing like a hyena. Of course, with hindsight, it was completely stupid. Why would April be hanging outside her own window? There was no way she could have got in such a position by accident. And so Hannah had forced herself to laugh too, and had recounted the incident over breakfast as a joke against herself. In truth, though, she hadn't found it particularly funny. It struck her as pointless and a little unkind, even dangerous to the extent that April could easily have fallen and broken her neck for real. Climbing out of the window had been fairly easy, according to April, but getting back up proved a lot harder. After Hannah had made two fruitless attempts to pull April back into the room, April had given up and clambered perilously down a very rusty drainpipe, losing a chunk of skin in the process. It would, Hannah reflected bitterly, have been considerably less funny if April had actually fallen to her death. But you weren't allowed to say things like that if you were the butt of a practical joke, or you looked sour and humourless.
"Who's a bitch?"
The voice came from the doorway to the hall, and Hannah and April both turned sharply.
"Emily!" April said. She put a hand over her heart. "Jesus, don't do that to me! You gave me a heart attack!"
"Sorry. Are you coming, Han? I was calling your mobile, but you weren't picking up."
"Oh, shoot, sorry. It didn't ring. I must have run out of credit again. Are you sure you're not coming?" she said to April, but more to show willing than anything else. April never came to formal hall. She claimed it was because she thought it was stuffy and pretentious, both of which were true, though Hannah had a weakness for the ceremony of it all. The Hogwarts theatricality of the rows of black-gowned students, the polished oak benches, the glimmering little lamps dotted all around, the Latin grace. But Hannah suspected it was something else, something to do with April's odd relationship with food. The way she would eat six McDonald's cheeseburgers in a row while out in Oxford on a Saturday night, but then skip lunch every day for a week. In formal hall, there was no escape from the full waiter-serviced three courses of it all. No possibility of taking a side salad or scooping your still-laden plate into an anonymous pile at the hatch. You had to order a full meal and then sit there, waiting while everyone else finished until the staff came to clear. "I'd rather drink bin juice," April said now, but amiably, and Hannah shrugged.
"Okay, suit yourself," she said, and followed Emily from the room.
Ryan was waiting for them at the foot of the stairs, and together they made their way across the quad in the gloaming. It was November already, and the nights were drawing in. All around them were the crisp autumn air and the light shining out through the chapel-stained glass.
"So, who was the bitch?"
Emily asked again, and Hannah rolled her eyes. "Ah, Sue. April thinks she's holding a grudge, you know, over the glitter."
"God, I'm not surprised. If she tries any of that shit with me, I will end her,"
Emily said. She looked surprisingly furious.
"It's not funny. It's actually pathetic. I heard about it from my scout, you know. They talked to each other. Sue spent hours hoovering up glitter and getting it out of her hair. If I was her, I'd have reported April to the master."
"I think she did get a telling off," Hannah said cautiously. She hitched up her own gown, which was sliding off one shoulder. She felt uncomfortable, as if she were bitching about April behind her back. "I'm not sure from who, but someone came to speak to her."
"Yeah, but did anything happen? I'm willing to bet good money the answer is no."
"I wasn't there, but the impression I got was that there would be consequences if it happened again," Hannah said, but she knew it sounded weak.
"I expect Daddy made a few calls and it magically got dropped," Ryan said sarcastically. "Will's a sound bloke, but I don't know what he sees in her. I really don't."
Hannah bit her lip. She couldn't blame Ryan for his annoyance. He was still smarting from the business with the phone call. But April's family wealth had been a bone of contention even before that. The extent of the family holdings, the donation her father had made to the Pelham College gym. And it wasn't just Ryan.
"April Clark Cliveden," Hannah had heard someone say as she passed them in the cloisters on her way to a tutorial.
"That it girl?"
"Oh, she's thick as two short planks. She wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her dad's money. He's like one rung down from Warren Buffett or something."
The odd thing was that April herself did nothing to dispel the rumours. In fact, she seemed to revel in them. Her Instagram feed was a slew of designer clothes, boys in tuxedos and shots of herself drinking champagne from the bottle and pouting at the camera. She seemed to take pride in the notion that she did little or no work and yet still got good marks. And Hannah had heard her mention her unconditional offer and poor exam results more than once, as if daring people to put two and two together. But it wasn't true.
That was the thing. April wasn't an airhead, not at all. She liked clothes and parties, that much was true, but what her carefully curated Instagram feed failed to show was the hard work behind the scenes. Hannah had lost count of the number of times April had staggered home at midnight, ripped off her heels, and then pulled an all-nighter on some assignment due the next day. Hannah had proofread a few of those essays over breakfast as a favour to April. She had gone in trepidatiously the first time, expecting a load of plagiarised points, ramblingly regurgitated. But to her astonishment, the essay was good, even brilliant in parts. Hannah was no historian, but she could recognise good writing, and these papers were much better than anything completed after half a dozen cosmopolitans had a right to be. They deserved the marks April was getting, maybe even more. It wasn't just the essays, either. A couple of weeks ago, Hannah had walked in on April rehearsing for her part in a play she was supposed to be performing with the drama club before Christmas. And she had stood in the doorway, completely transfixed, goose pimples running up and down her spine. April wasn't just some wannabe starlet. Maybe it girl was right, though. Whatever it was, she had it.
"You know,
she began to Ryan. But as she said the words, they passed the porter's lodge and Hannah remembered something.
Oh, I'm really sorry. I'm expecting a letter from my mum. Can you hang on for 2 ticks while I check?
Don't be long, Emily said, and Hannah nodded and ran up the steps. Inside, it was warm and stuffy, with a strong smell of something that might have been damp cloth or an oddly musty kind of B.O. She made her way over to the rows of pigeonholes and peered inside her own. Nothing apart from a library slip reminding her about an overdue loan, which was really odd. Her mother's letter was a pretty regular Friday occurrence. Had it got misfiled? It wouldn't be the first time. She was just peering into the pigeonholes above and below her own when she heard a reedy voice behind her.
Looking for something?
She turned, with a jump, to see the porter standing there, the one she had met on her visit to Dr. Myers's office. He had come out from behind the desk and was standing next to her, just slightly too close for Hannah's comfort. She took a step back.
No, I mean, I was expecting a letter. My mum writes to me every week, but I don't know if it's here.
Just arrived. I was about to put it in your pigeonhole.
He held it out towards her between two fingers, and Hannah reached for it. But to her surprise, he jerked his hand back, holding the letter just above her head, with what seemed to be meant as a jovial expression. Hannah frowned, and he held it out to her again. And again, when she reached for it, he pulled his hand back. This time, Hannah folded her arms, looking at him, refusing to reach for the letter. Her heart was quickening in a very uncomfortable way. There was nothing she could put her finger on, but this whole interaction felt so deeply off balance, so odd and unprofessional, that she just didn't know how to proceed. It reminded her, unsettlingly, of that moment on the first day when he had dangled the keys and then held on to them for just a beat too long.
"Can I have my letter?" she said at last, and was irritated to find that her voice wobbled a little on the final word. She glanced out the window. Emily was standing there, glaring at her. As Hannah met her eyes, Emily held up her watch, pointing at the dial.
"I know," Hannah mouthed through the glass, trying to convey her predicament. She couldn't go out and get Emily or Ryan to back her up. That was too pathetic. But she did wish one of them would come in after her.
"Can I please have my letter?" she repeated. And this time her voice sounded stronger, more annoyed.
"Course," Neville said.
He gave a broad smile and held out the letter for a third time, and this time when Hannah reached for it, her heart pounding, he did not snatch it away, but let her slide it slowly from his fingers.
"All you needed to say was the magic word. I like polite little girls."
For a minute, Hannah wasn't sure what to say. Polite little girls? Was it sexism? Was he coming on to her? Or was this just some weird paternalistic bullshit, like she reminded him of his own daughter? Neville was grinning at her, as if waiting for a reply. But instead of giving him the satisfaction of a thank you, Hannah turned on her heel, pushing back the door of the porter's lodge so hard that it banged against the wall, and stumbled out into the cool night air, her cheeks still blazing with a mixture of anger and discomfort. Afterwards, talking it over during formal hall with Emily and Ryan, she almost couldn't believe her own memory of the exchange.
"And that's really what he said?"
Emily was incredulous.
that he likes polite little girls?
I mean, I'm pretty sure, Hannah said. It's creepy, right? I'm not overreacting here.
Too fucking right. It's creepy. It's gross. You should report him to someone.
Look, he's got to be 50 if he's a day, maybe even 60, Ryan said. That's my granddad's age, and that's just what they're like, aren't they? Old blokes, different generation. You've got to make allowances. He probably didn't mean any harm.
He probably didn't, but the fact is, it's really fucking patronising. Please tell me you're going to report this, Han.
What? She's going to report him for being a bit old-fashioned? What's next, me suing the scout for calling me ducky?
It's not the same, and you know it, Emily shot back.
As she and Ryan continued their argument, the conversation drifted away. Emily ranting about sexism and the patriarchy, Ryan goading her by pretending to miss her point. But Hannah found herself preoccupied, thinking over Ryan's words. Because the thing was, he was probably right. John Neville probably didn't mean any harm, and she couldn't see herself reporting the incident as Emily had suggested. What would she say?
He pretended not to give me my letter and I felt uncomfortable.
Because that was the bottom line. It wasn't anything specific he'd said or done. And although the little girl's remark was weird, there was not much else she could put her finger on. But he had made her feel uncomfortable. He had made her beg for a letter that was rightfully hers. And there was something about the power play underlying the whole exchange that made her skin crawl. She found herself surreptitiously wiping her mother's letter on her knee, even though she knew it was ridiculous. After dinner, Ryan and Emily disappeared to meet some friends of Emily's from another college, and Hannah finished off the remains of the wine they had ordered with a group of girls from Clodes who all knew each other. When they filtered away to the college bar next door, she realised she was more or less alone in the hall, apart from a group of tutors still chatting over coffee at high table and the staff clearing away plates. At the door, she found herself uneasily glancing at the golden light filtering out from the windows of the porter's lodge and wondering when the shifts changed for the night. Would John Neville still be there? Would he see her walking across the old quad? There was no other exit from the hall and no way of getting back to New Quad that didn't involve cutting across the line of sight from the lodge. It had been deliberately positioned to give the porters a clear view of visitors making their way across the college grounds.
She knew she was being slightly ridiculous.
But at the same time, there was just something about the thought of him lying in wait, maybe even coming out to ambush her, that set her skin crawling with a mix of fear and revulsion. Had he really been shelving her letter at that exact moment? Surely the post came in the morning. Or had he held on to it, waiting for her to come and look for it so that he could play his strange little game? She was still standing in the doorway to the hall, hesitating, when she heard a voice from behind her.
Everything okay?
Turning, she saw Will's friend, Hugh. He was wearing a bow tie and his academic gown, and his glasses were slightly askew in a way that made him look a little comical and perhaps a little drunk, too.
Oh, Hugh, she said gratefully. Yes, everything's fine. I was just thinking about turning in. Are you heading back to Clodes?
Actually, I'm off to the library.
He straightened his glasses, blew his hair off his brow, and gave a slightly rueful grin.
Got to pull a late on an essay I was supposed to hand in today. I've got an extension until tomorrow.
I told old Bates that it was written, but the printer wasn't working, when the truth is, I've not written a word. Do you want me to walk you?
Hannah hesitated.
New Quad wasn't really on the way to the library, at least not without taking a considerable detour, but the thought of kindly, horn-rimmed Hugh's reassuring company was very tempting.
Would you mind? She said at last, and then laughed.
Sorry, that's such a stupid thing to say. You could hardly say no when I put it like that. Honestly, I'm fine either way, I promise.
But maybe Hugh was less drunk than he looked, or more perceptive. Whichever it was, he shook his head.
It's fine. I'd like the fresh air. Probably need sobering up, to be honest.
He took her arm.
Come on, old thing. Half-league, half-league, half-league onwards.
He imitated a hunting horn, setting the crows that lived in the trees around the quad crying and wheeling in irritation. Hannah laughed, and they set out into the night together.
After. They made a mistake. The words are ringing in Hannah's ears as she shoves a tenner down on the table and shoulders her way blindly out of the cafe. Outside, she leans with her back against the wall, feeling the drizzle on her face, her breath coming quick. They made a mistake. Emily chose her words with care, but that they is a euphemism, and they both know it. Because in spite of the police, and the forensic experts, and the judge, and the jury, and everyone else involved in convicting John Neville of April's murder, there is only one person that they really applies to. Hannah. Because it was her evidence that sent John Neville down. She was the one who told first the police and then the courts about his behaviour. It was her name on the harassment complaint submitted to the Pelham College authorities, a complaint they brushed under the rug, later issuing fulsome apologies to both Hannah and April's family for their dismissive attitude. And it was she, Hannah, who saw John Neville that night hurrying towards her out of the gloom, head down, away from Staircase 7. What they made a mistake really means is you made a mistake. You, Hannah, you convicted an innocent man. And suddenly, she cannot do this. She cannot do this anymore. Not any of it. Not the memories crowding her head, not the voices in her ears, not the faces in the crowd around her looking at her curiously as she puts her hands over her face and screams silently, internally, wanting nothing more than for it to all just stop. She becomes aware that she is making a strange sound, like a sobbing moan. And a woman touches her on the shoulder, her face full of concern.
Are you all right, Doc? Says it the baby.
No, she manages, though the word comes out like a wail.
No, I'm fine. Leave me alone. Maybe you've had a wee bit of a shock, the woman asks kindly, but Hannah cannot take it.
She cannot take the woman's well-meaning concern. She cannot talk about any of this.
No, I mean, just leave me alone, she chokes out. I'm okay.
And then she pushes past the woman, stumbling away into the rain. She is not okay. She is very far from okay. But it is not because Em's words were a shock. It is the exact opposite. It is because Emily echoed the voice that has whispered in her sleepless ear every day and every night for 10 years. Did she? Did she make a mistake?
before. By the time the Michaelmas term drew to a close, just 8 weeks after it started, Hannah found it hard to remember a time when she had not been a Pelham College student. The labyrinthine corridors and golden stone cloisters were as familiar to her as her old school halls back in Dodsworth, and outside the high walls of the college, even Oxford with its off-putting patina of strangeness was starting to feel like home. She had learned to call exams collections, the Thames the Isis, and that people studying the classics were taking greats. She knew the difference between rectors, provosts and wardens, and the place of Pelham's own master in that subtle pecking order. She had her favourite pubs and curry houses, and was beginning to figure out the shortcuts and winding back ways that students used for slipping between colleges and making their way to the Bodleian when the college library didn't suffice. She let Emily drag her around the Saturday morning flea market and Hugh take her to the History of Science Museum. She went to Oxford Union debates with Ryan, followed by furious political discussions in the pub after, and she adopted the weary tolerance the older students displayed towards the ever-present tourists with their iPhones and their selfies. She even got used to April, to her constant Instagram snaps, to her face staring out of the Tatler gossip pages, to the half-drunk bottles of Veuve Clicquot crowding the mini-fridge, and the scent of her strange heavy perfume. After a few weeks, it felt normal to find a Vivian Westwood coat discarded underneath the sofa, or a Vera Wang camisole crumpled up with the laundry. Her trainers tangled companionably with April's Jimmy Choos in a pile beneath the coffee table. Only two things she did not get used to. One was John Neville, who remained a constant, disquieting presence hovering at the edge of her perception. She found herself taking the long way to the library to avoid passing the porter's lodge, going in to collect her letters when she guessed he would be off shift, and entering college by the back gate to avoid passing through the main entrance. The other was Will. Somewhat to everyone's surprise, it appeared that April and Will were now an item. It was never spoken, never articulated that April was anything as pedestrian as Will's girlfriend, but from that first night when they had played strip poker together, Will became a semi-regular overnight guest in April's half of the set, and it was not uncommon for Hannah to wake to the sound of his deep voice coming through the wall, or to leave her room in the early morning, long before April usually awoke, to find him on their sofa, drinking coffee, and looking across the dew-drenched quad. The first time Hannah had woken to find Will sitting alone in the set, he jumped like a guilty person, caught doing something he should be ashamed of. "I'm sorry," he'd said quickly. He stood up, crossing his arms over his bare chest. He was wearing nothing but jeans, and she had to force her eyes up, away from his lean, muscled body and the fine ribbon of dark hair that arrowed to his belt buckle.
"I'm really sorry. I didn't think you'd be up yet. I didn't want to wake April. I'll go."
"Hey, it's fine," Hannah said. She focused on a point just past Will's right ear. "You don't need to go. Finish your coffee."
"Are you sure?"
He looked at her doubtfully.
"I don't want to take the piss. I mean, this is your room. I don't know how I'd feel about a stranger hanging around, uninvited."
Hannah found herself laughing at that in spite of herself, and for the first time she found herself able to look Will in the eye, sympathetic to his awkwardness. "Will, first, you're hardly a stranger. And second, you're not uninvited."
April invited you.
But you didn't,
he pointed out. She smiled. OK, I invite you, Wilder Chastain. Is that better?
OK,
he said, and then his face broke into a grin.
Vampire rules, you know. I'm over the threshold now, you can't get me out.
Don't suck my blood, she said lightly. There was a moment's charged pause. Then Will coughed, breaking the tension.
Still, I'd better get a shirt on. Pretty sure vampire rules don't entitle me to lounge around half-naked.
Don't worry, Hannah said. I was heading out for a run, anyway. I like to go in the morning before the river path gets too busy.
Sounds nice, Will said.
And then he smiled. And Hannah realised that she wasn't having to force her gaze away from his chest, because her eyes were locked on his face, on the way the lines at the corners of his mouth crinkled, on his crooked nose and the shape of his lips.
I'll probably be gone by the time you get back,
he added, and she nodded and made herself look away.
Sure.
Her voice sounded croaky in her own ears. See you later, then. Maybe at breakfast.
Maybe at breakfast,
he echoed, and she laced up her trainers and left, taking the four flights at a run. But he wasn't gone when she came back, not completely at least. He was gone from the living room, an empty coffee cup the only sign of his presence. But as she opened the door to the set, the sound that greeted her from behind April's door was the unmistakable one of two people having sex. Hannah found herself wincing as she tiptoed across the living room to her own door. Once safely inside her bedroom, she shut the door and turned on the radio, a notch louder than necessary. She had been planning to take a 10-second shower, then work on an essay in her room. Instead, she showered, left her towel hanging on a peg in the communal bathroom, and went straight down to breakfast with wet hair and scrubbed face. But to her surprise, when she walked through the door to the hall, Will was there, eating a full English. He saw her as she came in and waved a fork.
Hannah, over here.
He had nearly finished, she saw. And as she moved across to him, frowning and trying to figure out how he had got down here so fast, let alone finished the best part of eggs, bacon, sausages, mushrooms and beans, he swallowed a mouthful and spoke.
Could I be cheeky and get you to grab me another coffee, if you're going up?
He held out his empty cup. Hannah took it, feeling slightly dazed.
Sure.
She had turned half away from the table when she remembered something and turned back. Sorry, how do you take it again? I should know, but...
Black, no sugar. Thanks.
Hannah nodded and moved away to join the queue at the hatch. But she could not shake the feeling of unease as she stood there, Will's still warm cup in her hand, waiting to be served. Had she been in the shower longer than she thought? Or... But no, that was ridiculous. Will was, well, if not April's boyfriend, at least a significant fixture in her life, and she had seen him going into April's room herself that very morning. She had made a mistake, that was all. Just a silly mistake. After. In the restaurant, Hannah looks at her phone again, gnawing at a breadstick. Wednesday night is date night. It always has been, virtually since she and Will moved in together, when they realised that between book events for Hannah and accountancy exams for Will, they needed to carve out time for each other. For the first few years, it was nothing fancy, fish and chips on summer evenings in Prince's Street Gardens, the castle glowing red gold in the sunset, and the hills shining in the distance. Popcorn and a movie at the Edinburgh Film House, then McDonald's on the way home. Lately, as Will has moved up the ranks at Carter and Price, the restaurants have become nicer. And tonight's is one of their favourites, a cosy little Italian place tucked along one of the winding medieval lanes leading down from the grass market, not far from Tall Tales. But Will is late, and now, as Hannah stares down at the menu she knows practically by heart, pregnancy hunger growling in her stomach, she notices the prices for perhaps the first time since they started coming here. It's not cheap. In fact, tonight is going to set them back about the same amount as their weekly supermarket shop. They are going to have to cut back when the baby comes.
"Can I get you anything to drink, or are you still waiting for your companion?" says the waiter, passing her table with his order pad in hand.
Hannah is just about to reply when a tall figure appears behind the waiter's shoulder. "Will!" Relief washes over her.
"Sorry," Will says, half to her and half to the waiter. "I'll order fast, I promise. Can you come back in 5?
The waiter nods and departs, and Will bends to kiss her. As his lips, still cool from the crisp evening air outside, meet hers, she closes her eyes, feeling her body go liquid with it. That need that never goes away, that still unbelieving realization that Will is her husband.
"I love you."
The words come out in spite of herself, and he smiles, holding on to her hand as he takes his seat, his strong fingers linking with hers as he picks up the menu with his free hand, scanning the specials. He is her kryptonite, she thinks as she watches him read, one thumb absently stroking the back of her hand. She has never told him this, but she knows how Superman feels when they brandish the green sticks in his face. The way his strength deserts him and his limbs go weak, because she feels exactly the same way when Will touches her. Dazed. Stupid. Meltingly soft. And it has always been so. Ever since that first day in the hall at Pelham. He has always had that power over her. Sometimes the realization makes her almost afraid. After they have ordered, Will runs his hands through his black hair, making it stick up like a hedgehog's spines, and sighs.
"I'm sorry I'm late. Massive cock-up with a client account that needed sorting, and I couldn't really run out."
"It's fine," she says, "because it is, now that he's here." "I get it. Now isn't the time to be coasting, what with the partnership thing."
"I know, but today of all days..."
"I'm fine. I didn't sit at home all day moping. I went to the park, then the cafe. I talked to Mum. She's going to come for a visit sometime, bring some maternity clothes. And, well, actually..."
She pauses. For some reason, the words don't quite come naturally.
I also talked to Emily.
Emily?
Will raises an eyebrow. She's not sure if he's surprised or just making conversation. "Yes, she called me, in fact. She'd seen the news. Did you know she was back in Oxford?"
"Yes, I told you, remember? I heard it from Hugh."
Hugh is the one person from college they both still see regularly. He and Will are best friends, have been since they were little prep school boys in short trousers, and perhaps because of that, their bond survived the earthquake of April's death. It helps that Hugh also lives in Edinburgh, in a beautiful bachelor's flat in the elegant Georgian quarter near Charlotte Square.
He and Will play cricket for a local team in the summer months, and Hugh comes into the bookshop most Saturdays, buying whatever literary hardback the Sunday Times has recommended. The three of them meet up for dinner or brunch every few weeks. But until today, she had no idea that Hugh and Emily were in contact at all. They weren't even particular friends at Oxford. They hung around together because Will was dating April, and Hannah was April's roommate, and Emily liked Hannah. But beyond that, they had nothing in common. Hugh was shy and bookish, and 13 years at an all-boys school had left him awkward around girls. Emily was sharp and spiky, with absolutely no time for the kind of old-fashioned courtesies Hugh had been brought up to think were necessary when dealing with women.
"Emily said he'd been down for the Gordy," Hannah says now.
"It's weird. I would never have put them down for the ones to keep in touch."
"I know."
Will takes a breadstick and crunches it meditatively.
"They were never that close at Pelham. In fact, I always got the impression she thought he was a bit of a joke."
"He is a bit of a joke," Hannah says, but not unkindly. She doesn't mean it as a put-down. It's just that Hugh is, well, he's Hugh. Posh, floppy hair, smudged glasses. He's Dead Poet Society crossed with four weddings and a funeral. Everyone's caricature of a public schoolboy grown up.
"That's just the surface, though," Will says,
and she nods, knowing it's not just Will defending his best friend, it's also true. Because although Hugh may come across as slightly effete, the reality is very different. Underneath the self-mocking veneer, Hugh is tough and driven and very, very ambitious. It's why he's done as well as he has. Will's family is old money, not that there's much of it left now, apart from some land and a few paintings. April's was new. Her father came from nowhere, a brash Essex boy who made his fortune in the city and cashed out at the right time. But Hugh's family were neither, in spite of his schooling. His father was a GP, his mother a housewife, county folk who scraped together the money for their only child's education, going without themselves, even as they pinned all their hopes on him. That sacrifice is something Hugh has been trying to justify ever since he left Pelham, and now, to a large extent, he has succeeded. He followed in his father's footsteps as far as graduation, but then went swiftly and lucratively into private practice. He's now the head of a very successful plastic surgery clinic in Edinburgh. One of his first clients was April's mother. Hannah doesn't know how much he earns, but she can tell from his flat that he must be extremely comfortable. You don't get a place like that in central Edinburgh for small change.
"So, what was she saying?"
Will continues, and Hannah has to drag her mind back to Emily's conversation. The sinking feeling in her stomach returns.
"She was saying..."
She breaks off. The waiter has arrived with their starters, and there's a moment's respite as they sort out whose is whose. But then Will prompts,
"She was saying..."
"She was asking if I was okay and..."
"Yes," Will says.
He's looking worried now, and puzzled, and maybe slightly irritated too, it's hard to tell. "There's this journalist. He's been trying to get in touch with her, and me. He's a friend of Ryan's, and he thinks..."
"Oh, God, this is hard."
She puts her knife and fork down, takes a deep breath, forces the words out. "He thinks there might have been a mistake. He thinks Neville's conviction was a miscarriage of justice."
"Bullshit!"
Will doesn't even stop to consider her words. His reaction is swift and decisive, and he slams his hand down on the table, making his plate and cutlery clatter and jump. The people at the neighbouring table look around in surprise, and Hannah winces, but Will doesn't lower his voice.
Utter bollocks! I hope you told Emily not to speak to him.
She already has,
Hannah says, her voice practically a whisper, as if to compensate for Will's. And then, seeing Will's expression, she backtracks.
Not about Neville.
They seem to have talked mostly about Ryan, but don't you think... She stops. Don't you think it's at least a possibility? Is what she wants to ask. But she can't quite bring herself to say the words. It's been hard enough turning them over and over inside her head without articulating them.
Sweetheart.
Will puts down his cutlery and reaches across the table, holding her hand, forcing her attention.
Hannah, don't do this. Don't start second-guessing yourself.
And for what? Just because Neville's dead? His death changes nothing. It doesn't change the evidence. It doesn't change what you saw. And that's the thing. She knows he's right. Of course he's right. The fact that Neville went to his grave protesting his innocence proves what, exactly? Nothing. There have been plenty of murderers who denied their guilt until their dying day. But the truth is that Neville could have been heading towards parole by now if he had played the game, accepted his guilt, done his time. Instead, he spent the years after April's death protesting his innocence and launching futile appeal after appeal after appeal, all of which achieved nothing except to keep his name in the press and public anger high. Would a guilty man really have shot himself in the foot like that?
Hannah, Will says.
He squeezes her hand, forcing her to meet his eyes.
Hannah, sweetheart, you know that, right? This is not your fault.
I know, she says.
She withdraws her hand, shuts her eyes, rubs at the headache that is beginning to build beneath the plastic nose rest of her glasses. But when she shuts her eyes, it's not Will's face that she sees, full of love and concern. It's Neville's. And not the Neville that has dogged her since university, glowering full of belligerent defensiveness. It's the one she saw the other day. The haunted, hunted old man, staring out of the screen with a kind of pleading fear. And she knows what Will said. It's not true. This is all her fault. All of it.